This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. What can a law student learn about professional ethics from a trip to Auschwitz? It's not hard for anyone who visits a concentration camp to experience sadness and horror. You will easily identify with the victims and the liberators. But can you possibly imagine yourself as a collaborator? The fellowships at Auschwitz for the study of professional ethics hope so. It's an intensive 2-week program that teaches business, journalism, law, medical, and seminary students about the role that professionals played in the Holocaust. It asks the question, how do personal and institutional blindness lead to epic tragedy? Eric Muller is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he recently participated in a fellowships at Auschwitz program. And he's with us on the program today. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. Thank you.
Tell me about the program and your role in it.
Well, it is, as you described it a moment ago, it's a program that has been around for a couple of years, run out of the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York, that is designed to help young professionals or people in training think about their developing roles as professionals and to confront the question of the degree of moral freedom that they have in their roles. The idea is that by bringing people to invoking the power of place, bringing people to Berlin and then to Poland, the discussion will move to a deeper, more visceral level. And I can tell you, having just gotten back from 2 weeks on this trip, that it certainly works. My role was actually a comparative one. My main area of expertise is actually the internment of Japanese Americans in the United States during World War II. For several years now, I've been working on research about the roles that lawyers played in facilitating that repressive system. So my at least formal rationale for being on the trip was to offer the students an American domestic comparative perspective to these stories about German lawyers and judges that we were focusing on.
Though you did have a personal connection.
I did. I do. And it's something that you and I have spoken about before, actually. My great uncle, Leopold, was deported from the city of Würzburg in Germany on April 25th, 1942, to his death in Poland. And I've spent quite a bit of time over my life, especially in the last decade or so, trying to puzzle through that whole chapter in family history and what it all means. So yes, it had a personal – there was a sense of personal pilgrimage as well.
Had you been to a death camp before?
I had been as a much younger person. At 19 years old, I went to Dachau in just outside of Munich. Which actually was not a death camp. Many, many people died there, but it was not Auschwitz. It was not a camp that existed solely for the purpose of genocide. And then a few years after that, I traveled with my parents to the camp called Mauthausen, which is in Austria. Also a horrifically awful place, but not a place that existed purely to kill people. So this was my first visit to a camp like Auschwitz-Birkenau, which the Birkenau camp was, you know, beginning, middle, and end was a site of genocide. There was really no other function that it served.
And this trip had a different purpose. There was this mission. So tell us about the trip. Tell us about how it affected you.
Well, it affected me very deeply, and it affected me in ways that I think I'm still just trying to puzzle out. I was skeptical, actually, going into the trip a little bit because I was not certain that because of the Holocaust's enormity, in a sense, what, you know, some people argue over this, but one might call its uniqueness, would really make it a very bad teaching instrument. You know, it's just so off the scale of anything that an American lawyer might possibly confront, one hopes, that it didn't seem very likely to me that it would be possible to generate lessons from it. But I come back from the trip an absolute convert to this program. What it did, among other things, is it really helped me to think about how lawyers can, as part of their what seems to be the positive aspects of their role, end up facilitating systems of great evil. Lawyers are acculturated to service, to identification with their client, to trying any lawful means to obtain what the client wants, to obtain advantage for the client, as long as they don't actually break the law. This program helps one see and feel how lawyers in that system, operating in roles not terribly unlike those of American lawyers, ended up planning genocide. One of the very most powerful places we visited was actually not in Poland, but was in Berlin. We visited what's called the House of the Wannsee Conference. This was the conference in January of 1942 in which 15 sort of high-level German bureaucrats, over half of whom had law degrees, sat around a table in a beautiful villa overlooking a lovely lake and more or less planned the system of mass genocide that would then unfold starting a few weeks. Well, it was already underway, but that would really ramp up a few weeks later. These were civil servants. These were highly educated people. And as I say, these were people who were lawyers. They were government lawyers. They were bureaucrats. They were competitive with one another. They were jockeying for position. They were seeking professional advancement. In other words, they were doing all of the things that lawyers all over the world do. And yet in that system, they managed somehow to sit and calmly, coolly, rationally plan a system the likes of which we simply can't imagine. And then as the invitation to the conference said, they all went and had breakfast together. Mm. So it really helped me. It helped me think about how there are spaces that lawyers can exploit to try to bring their own moral compass to bear in their relationships with their clients.
It strikes me, though, from what you've just said, and given your skepticism going in, that this Holocaust is often treated as exceptional because it's so far off the scale, that what really happened was, in a lot of ways, you relearned the Holocaust and saw how ordinary it was. It was a bunch of ordinary steps and ordinary people, not about what ended up, but the small decisions going in before we knew the enormity of it.
That's right. Hannah Arendt, after the war, wrote about Adolf Eichmann, who was tried in 1961 for his participation in this enterprise. And she talked about the banality of evil, just the ordinariness of it, the regularity, the regular everyday nature of this program. But one of the things that we discussed and really were able to see is that she meant something slightly different too, which was not just that evil was kind of ordinary and regular and everyday, but that it was unreflective. The thing she was commenting on about Eichmann was actually how stunningly unreflective he was. He really lacked the capacity for reflection. He simply was doing his job ambitiously, and there was nothing beneath that layer. Yet we heard stories of people who actually were able to press down beneath that layer and find places and pockets of resistance even within the Nazi machinery, and who managed to do that and resist in small ways without then themselves being sent off to death camps. So the program, I think, is very effective in helping American law students think not just about World War II, but to think about, you know, all of the debates that we've had in our country about government lawyers drafting torture memos and authorizing Guantanamo. And I'm not even here taking a position on the merits of Guantanamo or those memos. I'm simply saying that it introduces very powerfully the idea that lawyers are not simply and solely the unreflective servants of their clients' will.
They do have competing ethical standards, it would seem to me. You said earlier one of the roles of the lawyer is to figure out what the client wants and figure out how to get there. That would be your ethical responsibility to a client. And the other one is to say to yourself as a human being, what does it mean to torture another human being? I mean, it seems to me you have to ask those two questions however you come down on them.
You have to, and I think that the program helped these young law students think about how there might be creative, small creative ways in the lawyer-client relationship in which carefully, delicately, sensitively, the lawyer can engage with the client about the ends that the client is seeking rather than simply viewing themselves as facilitators of their clients' objectives.
It also strikes me from what you said that if you take that Eichmann perhaps was an individual who is incapable of reflection, you're always going to find those folks in every profession. Does that mean it's the responsibility of the profession to create forums for discussion so that if individuals may want to go off on their own, we have collectively created a space where we talk about these things and reflect?
It's a very interesting question you raise, Frank. And yes, I think that I think the profession does have that obligation. The very last thing that we did, the last day of our meetings, we were in Krakow, Poland. the fellows or students had all made presentations, and we then briefly talked about the case of Padilla versus Yu. This is Jose Padilla, the alleged enemy combatant's civil case against John Yu, the Justice Department lawyer who drafted the torture memos. And in that discussion, one of the ideas that arose is that perhaps a civil lawsuit may not be the best way for damages for Jose Padilla to go after John Yu, but that instead perhaps the bar itself ought to be using a moment like this to encourage exactly what you said, which is consideration of whether the, you know, one might say almost mindless and ambitious implementation of the client, in this case the president's objectives, could instead be replaced or supplanted with some other model in which lawyers have the opportunity to engage with each other and with their clients about the merits of what's being contemplated.
Tell us about your students and how they changed over time. You talked about your skepticism going in. Did you notice any change?
Well, I it's a little early to tell. This was a spectacular group experience. We had students from Yale Law School, NYU, Columbia, Michigan, and Duke. Some of the Yale kids, I guess, knew each other. Students, I should say kids. Students knew each other beforehand, but most of the rest did not. I think that they all brought with them the kinds of, if anything, just the kinds of emotional concerns about confronting the kinds of atrocities that we were about to confront together. And what I saw was those sorts of things melt away, and a situation of great sort of co-feeling and support around discussion about professional identity. One can have wonderful conversations with students in a seminar room anywhere in a law school in the United States, but having it in a seminar room in the afternoon after you have spent a morning touring Auschwitz is really a unique opportunity. It's something I'll treasure, and I think the students felt the same way.
Did this trip dispel any of your ideas? Getting back to this idea of the Holocaust being such an outscale event, that trying to bring it down to human scale, it seems to me the most important thing you can do, because we're repeating it in small ways every single day here in the United States and elsewhere, and we just don't see it because it stands as such an exception. Did any of that change for you?
Well, yes. I was taking notes the entire time, and I repeatedly was most struck by individual stories that I heard about. For example, if I can just describe one, there was a police commissioner in Berlin in 1938 named Wilhelm Creutzfeldt, who at Kristallnacht, which was the night of broken glass, the night of pogroms across Germany against German Jews, learned that the SA, not the Hitler's SA, were in this gorgeous synagogue in Berlin, preparing to burn the place down and vandalize it. He grabbed his gun and a copy of an old law that protected that building as a historical structure, and went storming into the synagogue and drove them away, threatening to shoot them if they stuck around. And they slunk away. That synagogue was saved. It is there today. It's gorgeous. And Wilhelm Creutzfeldt received a verbal reprimand and then was allowed to continue being the police chief of that district. So those kinds of stories, and there were many others on the trip, those kinds of stories, I think, just stop you in your tracks and cause you to question this received understanding we have that the Nazi machinery was a machinery that simply ground up everyone and anyone who dared oppose it in any way. In the main, there's a great deal of truth to that. And yet, there are stories of people who found that space that I'm referring to, that space to stop and reflect, as Eichmann didn't, and to try, in maybe just in their own small way, to take some step to impede this machinery. And some of them, managed to pull it off.
We'd love to know the backstory. How was Creutzfeldt prepared? What kind of script had he been operating under that prepared him for that moment? That was obviously a life-threatening, but certainly he had to consider the consequences when he made that move.
And I just don't know enough about his own story to tell you.
It's a fascinating thing to speculate on. Then, all of that said, it's really not over, is it? The anti-Semitism, that's the other mistake in looking back at the Holocaust. It's over now. Thank God we're not like that anymore.
of course. And you know, in this country, we have our own sorts of fears and demonizations of internal enemies. I got to tell you that the trip ended in a strange way, just along the lines you suggested. We went finally to Krakow, Poland, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous city that was spared bombing and is therefore it's in its pristine, beautiful shape. And you go into the central market, and the tourist shops all sell these dolls of Jews. You can buy dolls that are depictions, the most stereotyped depictions of hook-nosed, hunched-shouldered, prayer shawl-wearing Jews holding money bags with their pockets stuffed full of little little coins. And you know, it was a sobering note. I'm not suggesting that Poland is racked with anti-Semitism. In fact, there's a kind of pro or philo-Semitism in many urban areas in Poland these days. But the persistence of this kind, these kinds of images, after you've come through come through Auschwitz and Birkenau, is quite a sobering way to end a trip.
Did this trip change the way you look at your work with Japanese internment camps?
Absolutely. I mean, it encourages me to come back to the materials that I'm studying, the enormous paperwork that was left behind by lawyers who staffed the Japanese American internment camps, and to look at it through this very lens. These were men, and they were all men, or virtually all men, who were both serving the management of the camps, the War Relocation Authority that was running these Japanese-American camps, but who also had responsibilities to try to be sort of a legal office for the internees themselves. And it is encouraging me to look at the ways you can almost see these lawyers as inhabiting this pocket of freedom, this space that I'm imagining, and trying to think of ways, while being a cog in the machinery, also to slow the machinery down, or to resist, or modify, or temper its more extreme manifestations. So yes, I think that the questions of this trip really call directly back to the work that I'm doing, and hopefully someday there will be a book that that tells us about this.
Well, we'll have you back for that. But before I let you go now, you said something very early on about the moral freedom, the amount of moral freedom that we have. And in this country, we assume especially that we have a great deal of freedom. And yet so often you'll hear professionals say, well, you know, I'm stuck. I got this job. I got a mortgage. And that's where it's going. The sense in every profession in this country, where we have so much freedom, that we're stuck. There's nothing I can do.
Well, and look, I hope that I'm not sounding glib about this. I'm not suggesting that those constraints aren't real. Certainly, even if Wilhelm Creutzfeldt was not sent off to Dachau, he wasn't promoted. These things come with costs, and I'm not suggesting that this kind of contemplative or deliberative stance would be cost free in an organization. People have real world constraints. People have ambitions. So I don't mean to suggest that this is you snap your fingers and the world reshapes itself around your desire to have a deliberative moral posture. I'm simply suggesting that we come to be so instinctively believing that there is no moral or deliberative space for professionals to occupy. I think that we might surprise ourselves if we allowed ourselves to play with the idea a little bit. Maybe there'd be a little more flex in the joints than we tend to think there is.
Eric, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Eric Muller is a professor at the University of North Carolina Chapel at Chapel Hill Law School. Just ahead on The State of Things, a preview of the American Dance Festival. Stay with us.